Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. You're probably aware of the studies in recent years that have correlated the data that had previously been gathered separately for two indicators. The first one was happiness or contentment, and the second was material prosperity. These two groups of data had not been correlated before because modern economic theory holds that ever-expanding material production and wealth has the effect of taking care of individuals' happiness and any social problems that might arise. But when researchers did plot these two streams of data on the same graph, they found that for nearly every country in Europe, for instance, during the post-World War II decades, the line representing material prosperity climbed steadily, and at the same time, the line representing happiness was sinking just as steadily. In the United States, happiness in these surveys peaked in 1954. In general, these studies have found that beyond a basic level of material comfort and security, happiness does not appear to be a matter of having conspicuous material possessions of the latest design. We can conclude that something essential, lots of interrelated elements actually, have been lost as the prosperity increased in our modern societies. But because of the gradualism of this process since World War II, it's rather difficult for us to sort out all the particulars and figure out what we've actually lost, and supposedly what we really didn't need. Moreover, we've experienced a speeding up and an intensifying of many of the corrosive dynamics in recent years with the pressures of globalization, neoliberal economics, and life lived online. The person I'll be speaking with today, however, had the rare opportunity to observe the transition of a society from a happy, effective way of living to a far less happy and less effective, if far more modern and consumer-based, way of living, a transition that took place not over decades, but in this particular society within a very few years. That is, my guest today was a member of a film crew who were the first Westerners to enter this country when its borders were opened to the world in 1975. What she saw there, and in the next few years, and the insights she derived from it, led to the activist work she's done for all the decades since then. My guest today is quite a remarkable person, Helena Norberg Hodge. She's the founder and director of the International Society for Ecology and Culture. She speaks seven languages, grew up in Sweden, and then spent many years in England, France, Germany, Austria, Spain, and the United States, in addition to time spent living in traditional cultures in Mexico, Bhutan, and Nepal. A pioneer of the new economy movement, she's been promoting an economics of personal, social, and ecological well-being for more than 30 years. She's a widely respected analyst of the impact of the global economy on people's identity, their community, and their local economy. And she's a leading proponent of the relocalization or decentralization movement as a means of countering those destructive impacts. Since 1975, Helena Norberg Hodge has worked with the people of Ladakh, or Western Tibet, which is now part of the Indian state of Kashmir, to find ways of enabling their culture to meet the modern world without sacrificing social and ecological values. Trained as a linguist, she was the first Westerner in recent times to master the Ladakhi language, and she co-produced the first Ladakhi English dictionary. Her book, Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh, has sold almost 500,000 copies. And it's a charming, brief, accessible explication of exactly what she found and concluded from what she was observing in Ladakh. Helena Norberg Hodge, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Tell us first about this initial phase of your work. When you went to Ladakh, what did you find?
I found the most amazing paradise, really. I had traveled very widely and seen many remote places, but here high up in the Himalayas was a culture that had been allowed to develop according to its own rhythms, in harmony with its own land and developing its own knowledge systems. And, well, I basically found people who would just seem radiantly happy and a place of incredible beauty. You know, everything was sort of artisan produced. You didn't have this sort of ugly industrial, you know, high tension wires and all that. And it was, yeah, it was just totally captivating. So I had gone out, you know, for 6 weeks to help make a film, as this area had just been thrown open to the outside world. But I became so enthralled that I decided to stay on, and my excuse was to work on a thesis on the language.
I remember you were saying in Ancient Futures, Learning from Ladakh, that when you first got there as a sophisticated European, highly educated, you were suspicious of how happy they were, and you thought maybe they were faking it as they saw these strange visitors walking along the road.
Yes, I think, you know, I suppose in retrospect, I realized that I was subconsciously skeptical. It wasn't even a conscious thought, but I realized that it somehow didn't really register because of this subconscious skepticism that later on, when I saw that changing and when I saw the sort of unhappiness and many of the traits that I've seen in our culture and other cultures coming in, it was so clear, the contrast, and I then became aware of how long it can take to shave away these blinders and preconceptions that we've been educated into.
Right, and in that particular situation, one of the reasons it happened so quickly is because Western Ladakh, or Western Tibet, called Ladakh, now part of the Indian state of Kashmir, is near the border of China, and so India considers it a sensitive area, and they wanted to establish assimilation into the Indian state. So they were sending in a lot of army trucks and building barracks and putting up the bazaars with the modern consumer products. Is that why it was such an accelerated process?
Yes, I mean, in fact, a lot of the army development had happened earlier, but it had been more out on the borders, and the sort of development process is what started more or less as I arrived, as the area was thrown open to tourism and development, and there was a development commissioner and all the experts, you know, from agricultural departments, you know, that were promoting, among other things, DDT and, of course, chemical fertilizers, but many things that had been outlawed in the West. And they were actually building a hospital, you know, primarily of asbestos, and people found bits of asbestos and started baking their bread on it. And so that, for me, became, you know, it became so obvious that ancient, ecologically-based cultures like that, who have this incredible wisdom about how to live in a more harmonious way, had no knowledge about the destructive impact of industrial products and the whole industrial system. So I became very active trying to provide information about what was happening in the rest of the world and why we had outlawed many things. And that also led on to demonstrating solar as an alternative to the fossil fuels that the Indian government was promoting. You know, they set up a diesel generator in the capital and brought in kerosene and coal for cooking and heating. And in the meanwhile, here was a place that had more than 300 days of sunshine a year and very intense. You know, it was up at 12,000 feet. So that, you know, launched me into this work of trying to demonstrate an alternative, more ecologically adapted development model.
Mm-hmm. And as I recall from the book Ancient Futures, you found a way to make that fit in with the traditional architecture, these solar panels. There's one more thing I'd like to talk about before we move on to your later work. In the book Ancient Futures, there's what I found a charming story about a play that you and people working with you in the Ladakh project wrote to convey more of what's actually going on in the industrialized world as opposed to what they're seeing in these ads and things on Barbie dolls and Rambo dolls suddenly in the bazaar. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, it was a play that, and we did several plays, but this particular one was with a monk I worked with, and it was basically showing that what they were being led to believe was modern and progressive and superior, which was this romanticized imagery of a Western urban consumer culture, which was conveyed not only in advertising, but also in films and radio and every form of media. And even the tourism reinforced this false impression. And so we did a play where we showed how in the West, while people in Ladakh thought it was modern to use DDT and strong chemicals for cleaning and bleach to lighten their skin and all kinds of things in the West.
And eat white bread and wear polyester.
Yes, exactly. White foam rubber bread and wearing polyester and using cement in the buildings. In the West, there was a trend towards a new modernity, which was more ecological, and where the natural, whether it was natural fibers for your clothing or building materials or food, more organic, natural agriculture, at every level, there was this movement to return to a better balance with nature, and that was the new trend. And so in this play, we showed that in a very humorous way, and we also turned it into a comic book that was called A Journey to New York, which had a young Ladakhi going to New York and seeing all these things with his own eyes. And this also developed into a program of ours where we realized that it's a lack of information about what's going on in the West, you know, really going on the ground, that is such an obstacle now to healthy change in the less developed, so-called less developed world. So we developed what we call reality tours, where community leaders came to Europe and some of them to America to spend some time and with their own eyes see what was actually going on, both the problems and the sort of solutions.
Mm-hmm. Right. And then that led over the years to your seeing that the same dynamic was being repeated on a different time scales in all kinds of communities around the world. And as I understand it, led you to found the International Society for Ecology and Culture. I'm very interested in this latest project that your center has done, and it's a film available on DVD called The Economics of Happiness. At first hearing, my listeners might think it's from that new field that's arisen called happiness economics, happiness studies. But no, this is a deeper, broader analysis and vision for what's going on now. And can you give a little overview of the film? And then I'd like to go into these eight basic points of globalization that you name in the film.
Yeah. Well, also just to say that I wrote a book about what had happened in Ladakh, the ancient futures one you mentioned, and we made a film based on that. And between them, they have now been translated into 50 languages. So very early on, I was getting messages from all over the world of people who wanted to translate this these materials and wanted us to come there. And they kept saying again and again, the story of Ladakh is our story too. So that was really what we wanted to show in The Economics of Happiness, a broader, deeper understanding of what's going on around the world beyond the sort of Anglo or even European worldview. There is a reality of a diversity of cultures that are being squashed by this globalization juggernaut. And we're absolutely convinced that the sort of reversal that we need to make goes with the grain of what people so clearly are longing for, what they want, one of them, of course, being well-being, happiness and well-being. But on every level, really, it would be a lot easier to go in the direction of the deeper needs of nature and people than what's being pushed on us now. So that's what we try to show with this, big picture and a deeper analysis. Of course, it's in an hour and 5 minutes, so it's hard to do it all justice, but we've been very, very thrilled by the response. This film, The Economics of Happiness, that just came out in last January, is already in 15 languages, so we're feeling very encouraged and also hopeful that there may be a sort of a waking up that will help us move away from the trajectory we're on now, which is this fundamentally, as we see it, the globalization agenda is the agenda that allows giant banks and corporations to become even more powerful and big, and essentially as an interlinked group, they're systemically interlinked and they constitute a type of empire that is running our governments. Even my native country of Sweden is moving in the direction of that globalized capital and completely dismissing the desire and the votes of their people. So I think it's very urgent that we wake up to that.
And I think it's been difficult in the United States and maybe in Europe for the public to really grasp what globalization meant.
Yes.
Because when it was first put through, all the editorials said, oh, this is great, a rising tide will lift all boats, and all you need is a laptop now to jump into the global economy. I mean, preposterous books like that were bestsellers. And books from the progressive quarter, or rather the progressive green, capital G, which means the eco-social vision put together, that were predicting exactly what this was going to mean, really never got reviewed in the mainstream press. And finally then, after the World Trade Association, World Trade Organization went into effect, and this New World Order, which is a carte blanche for the corporations, the transnationals, there started to be stories in the American press of problems that this laissez-faire, you know, moving national regulations out of the way so corporations could go into any local market, it was causing some problems around the world. So I think at this point, maybe there's an awareness that it's not working the way it was advertised, but I think there's still not among most people in this country an understanding of the real effects of globalization on the ground level around the world, and we're certainly starting to see it here with the export of all our manufacturing jobs. But I was interested in the film that you identify 8 simple facts about globalization, and I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about these. I'll just name them, and you can say more. The first one is globalization makes us unhappy.
Well, that sounds fairly simplistic, I know, but that's our very clear analysis and research around the world, that the globalizing economy, which is about, as we just said, giving giant corporations more power, is imposing an identity on people that is absolutely disastrous. It's a monoculture, fundamentally Western, that's being imposed on people, and it's concomitant with increased speed, competition, and stress. And we are seeing around the world, and it's particularly clear in societies like Ladakh, you know, and Bhutan, where things were opened up suddenly, that is leading to profound unhappiness. I mean, in a place like Ladakh, suicide was something that happened in a lifetime. People might have heard of one person. There's now a suicide a month, and it's mainly young people fearful of failure in this competitive economy, feeling that their own identity, their own looks, their own language are inferior.
And then the second point is globalization makes us insecure.
Yeah, the insecurity is, of course, both psychological and financial, because the whole system is concentrating, as we know, economic power in fewer and fewer hands. It's also going hand in hand with the technologization, where businesses are encouraged to use more energy and technology instead of employing people. And in so many of our activities, you know, particularly healthcare, education, and the arts, I mean, obviously more people in the equation would be more helpful. But even in agriculture, even in the building of our houses, in most of our basic needs, replacing people with technology is a disaster. And the end result is this artificial creation of unemployment and intense competition for jobs. The combination of the economic insecurity and the psychological insecurity is, you know, breeding not only depression, an epidemic of depression in most countries now. You know, in Japan, it's worse than in the West, but in America, in the UK, across the world, the depression is on massively increasing. But it's also breeding violence, and what we see is that when men are marginalized, both psychologically and economically, they're disempowered, there's a tendency to step on the women and on the children, on whoever is weaker. There is also an increase in conflict and crime of virtually every kind.
Mm-hmm. And then number three, globalization uses a huge amount of natural resources.
Yeah, there's a link between the globalizing economy, and we need to keep in mind that this is treaties that give banks and corporations more freedom to move in and out of different countries. They, you know, as a McDonald's or a Monsanto that wants to deliver and get the whole global population dependent on their products, there's a structural link between that and urbanization, for instance. These mega cities that are growing like a cancer are a direct consequence, or I should say a systemic consequence, of this deregulation of trade and finance. And that brings with it an enormous waste of resources. Once people are concentrated in these enormous mega cities, every pound of food they now eat uses gallons of petrol to get there. Mm-hmm. When you have a more decentralized demographic pattern, it's possible to use human waste. It's possible to use even trees for shading. It's possible to use natural resources in a way that is vastly more sustainable. And it's entirely possible to envision a future entirely dependent on renewable energy rather than nuclear or fossil fuels. So these structural links, it's so important that we understand them and study them. It's very poorly understood because there are very few people looking at the global situation from an ecological and grassroots perspective. Most
right.
of the global analysis comes from the top down, generated mm-hmm. by corporate think tanks.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly true in this country. So then number four is globalization accelerates climate change, global climate disruption.
Oh, massively. So as, I mean, the utter insanity of this system is that we are ending up using our taxes and subsidies to encourage production for export. This is actually deep in our economic system, the idea that specializing for export is in every region's interest. As these giant corporations have grown, this has become an utter madness. Most countries are importing and exporting the same product. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of tons of beef and veal in and out of countries, exporting as much milk and butter as they import.
Mm-hmm.
And as these products crisscross the globe, we're talking about the biggest contribution to CO2 emissions, and yet, because we don't have this global perspective, most of the environmental movement doesn't address this corporate contribution to CO2 emissions, but addresses it purely in point of the poor, you know, sort of cornered individual consumer who is suddenly mm-hmm. told, oh, you're over-consuming, you know, stop driving your car, change your light bulbs, trapped in a situation that makes it very difficult, and also where they know that this is not going to make such a big difference. So I think it's so urgent that we get this bigger picture to start making sense of what's going on and addressing the real issues. We have to think also, if tomorrow everyone sat down to eat breakfast from their region, no multinational would be making money.
but millions of smaller businesses and farmers would be making money.
Right.
There's this structural reason why we have this insane redundant trade
right.
that is the biggest contributor to CO2 emissions.
And that example you just gave is what we'll get into in the second half of this discussion, these positive alternatives which are well within our reach.
Exactly.
So point number five about these true facts about globalization is that globalization, economic globalization, destroys livelihoods.
Yes, it's threatening livelihoods worldwide, and it's, as I was saying earlier, structurally linked to this system that distances producers from consumers, and that through free trade treaties allows corporations to go off and produce in one part of the world, like China or India, where people can live on a dollar a day and sell to people who are earning $100 a day. In that system, the concentration of economic power and we need to keep in mind the concentration leads to an analysis and to data production about every fact under the sun that furthers the strength of global corporations that are using more and more energy and technology wherever possible and displacing people. Economists I've been working with call it a jobless growth economy.
Right.
So in the West, we're being replaced either by technology or by cheap labor on the other side of the world. But we have to remember that even in China and India, the destruction of the local economies and people being pushed into cities in search of employment means that even there, unemployment is being created. It didn't exist traditionally, and now it's accelerating very rapidly. In China, those who are lucky enough to have a job in a big corporation are working something on the order of 85 hours a week.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole system is so both emotionally and ecologically unsustainable.
Right. Now, with these last three, we'll have to go a little bit more quickly. Number six is that globalization increases conflict.
Yeah, well, of course, from what I just described, with this intense competition for jobs, what you see everywhere, even in my native country of Sweden, is that people whose livelihoods are threatened become less tolerant, more fearful of the other, particularly the immigrant. And it's because of this economic squeeze and the psychological insecurity that prejudice, fundamentalism, ethnic conflict are on the increase worldwide.
Mm-hmm. And then number seven, economic globalization is built on handouts to big business.
Yeah, this is so important as well that we really understand that our taxes are being used to subsidize big business. We're not only using our money, our collective money, to support big business to go bigger and more global and replace more people with technology, but we are also changing regulations so that we're deregulating global trade and economic activity while we are overregulating local. And this is so important that we understand this, because a lot of the smaller businesses and farmers around the world are becoming very right-wing because they see government regulation and they see taxation as killing them. And they do not see the role of big business behind the scenes. So it's leading to an anti-government, anti-green, anti-left position.
Mm-hmm.
And I really hope that our listeners are hearing this, because I think once we get a clearer picture of this and we start spreading it around the world, we'll be able to close the gap between left and right, between green and non-green, because the issues are completely linked, and none of us are benefiting from this corporate empire.
Mm-hmm. And last, economic globalization is based on false accounting, sleight of hand.
Yes, this accounting, you know, is primarily to do with GDP, and GDP is measuring only economic transactions, and that means the more commercialized things become, so when we intervene in processes that previously were natural, even including increasing pollution, so that our drinking water is so polluted we need to buy it in bottles, that means an increase in GDP.
Mm-hmm.
When we have more cancer, need more irradiation, health care, GDP goes up simply because money is changing hands. If we
right.
were to grow our own garden and have healthy food and have clean, healthy water, GDP would go down. So it's a madness that any of us who are thinking green allow this measure to exist.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. We have to pause now for the break.
You are listening to PRN.FM, the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Jim Menzel Joseph, host of the Art of Survival show on the Progressive Radio Network. Together, we will share a journey of discovery and a vision of creating a sustainable future for ourselves and for our planet. Tune in Sundays, 3 p.m. Eastern, or catch us on the archives 24/7. If you like the show, rate us on iTunes. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, I'm Karen Hartglass, the host of It's All About Food. Join me every Wednesday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time, where we talk about my favorite subject, food. Learn how you can make a positive difference in your life and all life on Earth every time you eat. To listen to the show, go to PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
Hi, this is Professor T. Love of Ebola Soul, a mixed stew of soul music. Come get your history lesson in soul music on Friday at 6 p.m. Eastern. Tune in as I play soul music from 1949 to the present. Also, listen to Ebola Soul in the archives. If you like Ebola Soul, rate us in iTunes. Come and catch a groove on Ebola Soul. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Oh, Jeff.
Yes, Lee?
I just want you to know.
What?
You occupy my heart.
Aw.
Cheater on the Rude with Jeff Chrysler
and Lee Papa. Thursdays, 8 p.m. Eastern. Check out our old shows on the archives.
Archives? That sounds like some weird yellow moldy paper stuff.
And you can listen to all of our old moldy shows at PRN.FM.
Did you hear the Progressive Radio Network has a new slogan?
It does.
It does.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you are coming with us.
That sounds sort of progressive.
It does, it does, but I think it needs to be a little more demanding.
Progressive Radio Network is moving forward,
and we
want you
to
come
with us.
Hi, I'm Dr. Len Saputo.
And I'm registered nurse Vicki Saputo. We hope you'll join us on our new time slot for our live call-in talk show, Prescriptions for Health, on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com on Mondays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time and 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
Sometimes a fever's not a bad thing.
Dreaming is really important to our health.
Laughter's the best medicine.
We should use our common sense.
If you miss our live show, you can always catch us on PRN.FM and DrSaputo.com. Archives.
Also, if you like our show, please rate us on iTunes.
The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
This is PRN.FM. The Progressive Radio Network is moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
All together now, and I'm speaking with my guest today, Helena Norberg Hodge. Before we move into your ideas for positive solutions to these problems globalization has caused, I'd like to add one point that wasn't in the film. I wish it had been, and I realize you couldn't put everything in, and I realize you personally know this, but I want our listeners to all be very clear about where globalization came from. In the film, you say globalization started 500 years ago, and I would say trade between countries started 500 years ago, but globalization as we know it today, the form of it we are living under and trying to cope with, was very carefully designed by the corporate sector in the President Bush 1 years, when they pushed the United Nations to allow a complete revision of the international trade rules, which were the Bretton Woods agreements that were made right after World War II. So the corporate sector at the negotiating table did not allow any representatives of labor or anyone speaking for the health of the physical planet. Instead, they just wrote their own rules that would get national regulations out of their way. And this was the revision of the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade, which went into effect in 1994 and established the agency, the World Trade Organization. And now corporations can bring grievances there and say, we don't like that national regulation in that country. It's a restraint against free trade. And the country, if they lose the grievance, and the United States has lost many of them, has to either change their internal democratically arrived at law or pay that corporation for what they say they've lost because of a regulation over here. So I say this because it's very important for people not to be taken in by what you read in the media. Well, it's a natural progression. It's the 21st century. Of course, we arrived at economic globalization. No, it was very carefully crafted, and it can be changed. But let's now hear about, it can be changed at the high levels where it's operating. It can also be changed on the ground level. So I would like to hear about what you see, the potential of something that's already started, this process of re-localization as a healing corrective.
Yes, I've been using the term localization to mean both a local community movement as well as a policy shift that I believe is necessary. And I do want to say that I, from a global point of view, from all these non-Western cultures, the destructive impact of trade really did start already 500 years ago with colonialism and slavery. And I think it's important for us to realize that, to understand why it is that on one side of the world people can be surviving on a dollar a day, and on the other side, you know, there's $100 a day. It's a build-up of a system that was unjust, because it started with force, with slavery and colonialism, and gave power to global traders. That may sound, therefore, that, well, we can't change it, but I think in a sense, once we see that more clearly, it also becomes easier to see why localization is a necessary, really, it's a prerequisite for healthier economies. Localization would be about moving towards a world where people have the right to determine their own production and trade rules, and where power would be much more decentralized. And these giant traders did get so much power already going back with colonialism and slavery. And as you said, Charlene, you know, with the Bretton Woods agreements, we were talking about a modern phenomenon that was, you know, criminal if people understood what it really meant, because it was turning into global rules, a system where banks and corporations would run the world. And, of course, the people who were doing it, even many of them didn't really see what they were doing. They were talking about managing the global economy to avoid depression. And I think we have to be really clear that from the left and the right, this process has been allowed to continue, you know, ever since that time. Blindly, both left and right have allowed the growth in power of corporations and banks. So localization for me is at the global level is about governments being forced to go around those same tables, get back around the same tables again, and insist that they are going to take control of those banks and corporations. Collaborative treaties that are going to be giving those corporations less and less power, and they'll have some time to readjust, to break up. General Motors would have to be United States and Toyota under Japan, and they'll be more accountable and visible, and there'll be a principle of subsidiarity where things like food, particularly food, but also other basic needs, need to be met from closer to home, and where people have far more power over the decision-making.
Let's explain to people where that concept of subsidiarity came from. It actually came out of Catholic social teaching in the papal encyclical 1932, which, of course, the world was in the throes of the Great Depression then. And it was a principle of decentralization, that nothing should be handled at a higher level than can be handled at the level closest to the local. So this has moved into general political theory from there.
Yes.
Go
and
ahead.
It's so important, I think, that people realize that this is about empowering people at the local level. And so when we talk even about the policy changes, you know, as you were saying, those treaties previously were essentially framed by the corporations. This time, civic society would need to be there, you know, representation from labor as well as the environmental movement. And what we have been promoting now for over 30 years is that we start building that new economy from the bottom up right now. And it's being done. And in my organization, we've been promoting local food economies now for at least 25 years. And we have found that almost everywhere these initiatives have started, and I'm talking about even in places like Beijing and Jakarta, where the movement is not as strong, but even there, they often happen from big cities. And they are about linking up farmers and consumers, shortening the distances, creating more direct relationships. And they are so successful, despite the fact that almost all the taxes, the subsidies, the regulations are working in the opposite direction. This movement has gained momentum over these decades now in a way that is truly astounding and so inspiring. There's a new farmers movement of young people who actually prefer farming to sitting in front of the computer, whether as lawyers or doctors. You know, we all seem to be spending our time in front of the computer now. And there are young people who actually prefer being outside, working in the natural world. And because localizing means diversifying, it's structurally linked to diversifying, you're talking about smaller scale diversified farms that are a world of difference from the giant monocultures with their machines, where migrant labor and slave-like conditions make the work pretty miserable. So it's a wonderful, and I really hope the listeners will, you know, on the ground, get out and experience it. They'll probably find wherever they are, there'll be an example of a local food movement starting.
Right.
Maybe a school garden, it may be a new farmers market, it may be a CSA. I think part of what we need to understand is how fundamental and important it is, but also how much more it needs support. In many places, people said to me 25 years ago, oh, Helena, be realistic, you know, it's not going to happen. Now they say to me, oh, well, it's already happening. It's usually, even where it's been very successful, we're still talking about something like 10% of the food consumed.
Right.
And there's a huge amount of propaganda being generated by corporate think tanks that tries to argue that it's not the best way to reduce CO2 emissions.
Yeah, I just saw another one of those in the paper the other day. But it is quite interesting that even though many of us have been talking about community-based economics, where you keep the money circulating largely in your town and your region, it didn't really catch on until farmers markets. It turned out that the catalyst turned out to be food, which we didn't really guess all those years ago. And I just want to say that you know, what you say is true. It's now that people experience that and the idea of a belt of farms around the town, it gives you food security. From that is growing, oh, I see, if we patronize local businesses, we also
have
economic security here.
That's right. And so what we're seeing is the emergence of business alliances, of small local independent businesses linking up together. And with the help of consumers doing a lot of the educational work, trying to influence the Chamber of Commerce, which is usually locked into a belief that bigger is better, although we can show so many statistics about how outside investment into your community or your country, you know, foreign investment into your country, is always going to take more out than it puts in. That's the whole nature of investment.
Yeah.
So you're not going to be putting money in unless you're expecting more money to come out. So really building it up from the local is so commonsensical, and it's showing itself to be so productive, and keeping money circulating in the local economy is benefiting all the entire local community, which is also why it is so. It's been shown to heal a lot of the divides between conservatives and Democrats, or you know, Republicans and Democrats, between people who were anti-green and the Greens themselves. You know, particularly around the farmers' markets, you see a wonderful coming together there. So I think the now further movements are towards setting up investment funds that would allow people to invest in pension funds at a local level, getting away from the manipulation and the blindness of this speculative global economy, which we now know is not serving our interests. Now, there are a lot of the obstacles have to do with the over-regulation of the local, which also takes the form of needing, you know, teams of lawyers and lots of money to just go through the paperwork to meet the regulations. So again, that area is one that really needs exposing. And we don't have much time because, you know, while this localization movement is growing and is so empowering and positive, at the same time, you know, our governments are supporting this globalizing juggernaut.
Right.
You know, that turns into gas fracking and nuclear and, you know, just disastrous effects. So we do need urgently to focus on education as activism.
Right. And also various ways to reduce the grip of the corporate druthers on our national policy. I want to say, too, that, a couple things. You do make the point in the film that what you're talking about is not some kind of purist, total self-reliance where you never import anything from outside your region. That's not the point. But it moves into the second item I want to mention here as we're getting toward the end of our conversation, and that is the fact that it's a matter of working with what is. Right now, governments all over the world have three mechanisms by which they do encourage one kind or another of economic activity and eco-social development. One is to regulate, two is to tax, and three is to subsidize. Now, right now, as you've said, all those are favoring the global export market, the corporate world. Can you talk a little bit about what that would look like if we shifted those same mechanisms in place to encouraging a different kind of economy?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, I think if we could see really that our governments are shaping the direction of the economy, we have these tools, and so every year is this huge amount of money that we have collected as taxes. How do we spend those taxes? You know, first of all, what do we tax and what do we subsidize, and then what do we regulate and what do we deregulate? First of all, with the taxes, one of the first things that needs to happen is that we stop taxing the good things, which above all is employment, labor, and that we put those taxes onto the bads, which are pollution. So we really want to, we could quickly transform the economy in a fundamental way towards more jobs and less pollution and less energy consumption very, very quickly by doing that. And it would be a huge relief. And we're not talking about eliminating all technology and not using energy and technology where it's
needed. We're running out of time here.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah. So, and with the regulations, again, you know, we just do not – at the moment understand the extent to which so much is coming in the name of hygiene and health and public protection.
Well,
is actually a corporate agenda.
There's much more about this on the website for the International Society for Ecology and Culture. That website is localfutures.org. It's full of very pragmatic relational wisdom about what we need to do now.
And if I could mention that the economicsofhappiness.org, too, one word, the economicsofhappiness.org.
Right. That's, you can get there from this site or a separate site.
Yeah.
So thank you very much, Helena Norberg Hodge, for coming on the program today.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
we're going to move over, as we do now, into the Arts Corner. And because my guest today has also worked in China and Japan, the poem for today is by a Japanese poet. And really, who does it better than the Japanese poets when it comes to expressing our deep interrelatedness with nature? Because no matter what the subject of the poem, it's always dynamically situated in the natural world. Japanese poems carry us along with just a few artfully chosen and arranged words until that moment when we're suddenly and instantly propelled from the immediate focus to a much larger scope. This poem I'm going to read is by Izumi Shikibu. She was an 11th century poet in Japan, and she's a member of the group there known as the 36 Medieval Poetry Immortals. I came across this poem in the book Nine Gates, which is a book about poetry by the American poet Jane Hirschfield. Wonderful book. This short poem does not have a title. Again, it's by Izumi Shikibu. Last year's fragile, vanished snow is falling now again. If only seeing you could be like this. And because my guest today, Helena Norberg Hodge, is a linguist, I've selected a song by Lisa Gerard. She's a composer and singer from Australia who invents her own language for every song she writes. She said that she doesn't really know where these words come from. They just arise from within her. And she's also said that after she had a child, she was watching her one day as a young toddler and listening to the sounds that she was making. These were kind of musical sounds that seemed to please the child. And Lisa Gerard realized then that her adult talent for creating words musically was probably always within her, and had somehow survived to what she called, survived the indoctrination. So this is a song called Sanvion - I Am Your Shadow. It's from the first CD she made, The Mirror Pool, after the group Dead Can Dance split up. This is Lisa Gerard. That was Lisa Gerrard singing Sans Bien, I Am Your Shadow. And by the way, she also wrote the score to the movie The Whale Rider. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're all available in the archives. If you like this program, the Progressive Radio Network would appreciate it if you would go to iTunes and like it there. Our opening song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week when we'll hear about the wellness movement and the various discoveries in what I call relational physiology. Until then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.